Been a remarkably quiet morning, hasn't it? The hymns were quiet. Helen's beautiful offertory, Barbara Lawrence's lovely solo, the choir's number. Maybe quiet is what we need after the hoopla of the last 10 days. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's Eve, about 5 weeks of feasts and family for those who like feasts and have family. A marathon of hyped up good cheer and gratitude and generosity, which leaves many people exhausted and many more feeling lonelier than at any other time in the year. Some because no one came to see them. Some because everybody came and there was laughter and renewal, and then everybody left. The house fell into silence. The beloved voices faded to faint whispers, and we knew it might be a long time before we were all together again. Ask any counselor, secular or religious, and you find out soon enough that those who suffer from loneliness, and there are more than we know, suffer from it more keenly through these holidays than at any other time in the year. Nothing new or surprising about that knowledge. Nothing new or surprising, in fact, about how painful loneliness can be. Whatever ancient Hebrew poet wrote the book of Ecclesiastes knew all about it. Two are better than one, he said. For if one falls, the other can lift up the one who fell. But woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help. We read magazine articles about how pervasive loneliness is in American life. And one character asks another in the comic strip Peanuts, "Do you know what you're going to be when you grow up?" To which the answer is lonesome. Isolation and loneliness are the themes of a great American novel by Thomas Wolfe. Not Tom Wolfe of the white suits and the New York address and the wickedly clever modern novels, but Thomas Wolfe of Asheville, North Carolina, who had the bad luck to publish Look Homeward, Angel in 1929, just as the stock market crashed. The preface to that novel states its theme that we never achieve total union with anyone. In the very best relationships, we come close, but even then, we have thoughts and hopes and longings we do not fully share. Some, in fact, we would not know how to put into words. So we touch, embrace, laugh, or cry together. But there is always and forever some solitary confinement. No one, no matter how loving, knows every nook and cranny of another person's mind and heart. So in his finest lyric style, Wolfe put it this way in his preface, and Laura Cross knew that sooner or later I would have to do this. Naked and alone, we came into exile. In her dark womb, we did not know our mother's face. From the prison of her flesh have we come into the unspeakable and incommunicable prison of this earth. Which of us has known his brother? Which of us has looked into his father's heart? Which of us has not remained forever prison pent Which of us is not forever a stranger and alone? We can look away from that knowledge most of the time if we have friends and family, but thousands of us find other ways to hide our ultimate loneliness. Some believe that those who drink too much are lonely and want to break out of the cocoon of inhibitions that seems to keep them from friendships and intimacies. Some think if we talk all the time, compulsively, especially if we talk constantly about ourselves, we may be driven by fear of loneliness, tossing a bridge of words across the gulf. Or perhaps we retreat so far into ourselves that we cannot talk at all. Dr. Frieda Fromm Reichmann argues in a clinical paper that the deepest loneliness, that of the schizophrenic, for example, so horrifies its sufferers that they can rarely articulate it. One day she asked a catatonic woman to indicate how lonely she felt. The woman raised her hand with the thumb lifted and the other four fingers bent toward her palm so the doctor could see only the thumb isolated from the four hidden fingers. And caught on, and so in a tender voice, the doctor said, "That lonely?" The woman's face suddenly loosened up in relief and gratitude, and her fingers opened. She began to talk about herself, not in speech at first, but by means of those fingers. Slowly the tension dissolved as her loneliness discovered a listener, and in that particular case study, the ending was happy. Not everyone reaches that desperate state, but we all understand what it means to be lonely. Ironically, the more crowded the church or the neighborhood gets, the lonelier sometimes we feel. We meet more people and know them less well. We have more acquaintances, but fewer friends. And we create all kinds of defenses. There is the lonely person who decides, "I'll be safe if I control everything." Or the one who says, "If I conform and do what they want me to, they'll like me." People who are really skilled in human relationships, learn how to see behind those disguises. And people who have, like us, a Christian commitment have no choice but to try to do the same. Not just by writing a check or painting a house or taking toys and dinners into desperate neighborhoods once a year, decent as those things are, but far more importantly, by making sure that whenever we can, wherever we are, we take pains to recognize the dignity and value of every single human being. And there are ways to do that if we want to do it. The very poor feel lonely sometimes because they are treated so differently from the rest of us. Two students at the University of New Brunswick did an experiment in which they dressed as economic opposites, one well-to-do, the other poor, and posed as customers in 29 stores, recording the treatment they got from salespeople. One of the girls remarked later, "I sure would hate to be poor." She had learned a lesson better than she could have learned it from any sociology text. "I have watched an experienced sales clerk of a certain type size up a customer in about 1/10 of a second and decide whether that one is worth courtesy. If we act that way, if we act that way, our profession of Christianity is a farce. There are ways to make frustrated and anxious people feel better who haven't the money to buy the gifts they'd like to give, and the ones who do that preach better sermons than any of mine. There are people lonely because they're dehumanized by the jobs they have to do. Some years ago, this dialogue took place in an automobile factory in Detroit. What are you making? C-429. What is C-429? I don't know. What becomes of C-429 when it leaves you? I don't know. How long have you been making C-429? 9 years. I doubt anyone here works in a place as deadly or dull as that. But there are other things that make us feel lonely. I spoke a moment ago of the very poor who feel estranged by their poverty. Ironically, the very wealthy sometimes feel lonely because they can't be sure how many people smile and visit only because they think it might be useful to be close to money. Children can be lonely, and we do wonderful things when we learn sensitive ways of touching their loneliness. I was deeply moved one time reading a book about Charles Darwin to find a wistful comment from his son. He said how many times after his father's death he had wanted as much as anything in the world to have his father pass behind his chair and, as he had so often done, put his hand lightly on his head for a moment. You may have seen a documentary the other day about kids who are pushed too soon and too hard by their parents to become tennis stars. One girl told how her dad would walk angrily away when she did not play well. And having burned out finally from being pushed too hard, she said in this interview with great bitterness, "If only one time, even when I wasn't doing so well, he had said, 'I'm proud of you,' it would have made all the difference to me." Children feel lonely enough without having to fear that the world is not a safe and secure place. Some of you know how fond I am of a little boy named Tanner, who moved to Bellingham, Washington a few weeks ago. You can imagine how it felt to hear this story about him. He had seemed to adjust pretty well for 3 or 4 weeks, but one night when my daughter said it was time for vocabulary drills, he balked for the first time. Balked in no uncertain terms, and she sent him up early to bed. When she went up in a bit to check on him, his eyes looked suspicious, and his lips were a little shaky, and he said, apropos of nothing that was particularly relevant to the moment, "I miss Jared." Well, Jared lives here, and Tanner had not made friends yet. My daughter tried to be soothing. "You really liked Jared, didn't you?" He nodded. And the lips trembled a little more, and suddenly he looked at her and said, "When are we going back home?" Even with Mom and Dad around, he was truly lonely. maybe for the first time in his life. I may have told you a long time ago the story that gave me a title for this sermon. I remember that when my son, Devin, was about 7 years old, he would be playing in the house while one or two others in the family would leave until only I was left in the study reading quietly. A little time would pass and I could hear him jumping and singing and talking to himself in some game. And then suddenly I could almost sense that he had become aware that he might be alone. There would be absolute quiet for a moment. And then a little boy's voice, touched with just the barest tremble of fear, would call out, "Is anybody here?" It was a good feeling to be able to respond quickly and say, "I'm here," and feel the relief surge back and hear the noises again of a small boy quite willing to play alone just so long as he was not really alone. And our needs, even if we are grown up, are not very different. Christ understood that as he understood so much else. We can see that best at the end of Matthew's gospel, but that ending has more punch if we look at the others. The conclusion to Mark seems to have been lost. And we now have some patchwork endings, rather awkward. Luke closes with the sound of happy praise in the temple. John ends by saying that the world itself could not hold everything that might be said and written about his Lord. But the Gospel of Matthew has the most beautiful ending of all. It closes with what a Jew might call the Shekinah, the promise of the never-failing presence of the Lord among those who trust him. "And be assured," he says, "I am with you always, even to the end of time." So he too understood how lonely we grow in this large house, and how sometimes in the quiet that falls upon our hearts, we cry out, "Is anybody here?" His compassion is infinite. He wants to say the comforting word, but as we have to remind ourselves over and over, he has no voice unless we speak.